I'm Jacob Heilbrunn, the editor of The National Interest, and it is my great privilege to have my friend and colleague, Robert Silverman, as my guest today. Bob is a longtime Foreign Service officer and now the editor of the magazine and online publication, the Jerusalem Strategic Tribune. Bob's latest piece on the website caught my eye, and I thought we should discuss it today. It is called Effectively Banning the Muslim Brotherhood. Bob, welcome, and tell us, how do we go about effectively banning the Muslim Brotherhood?
Thank you, Jacob. Thank you for that warm introduction. I think we, as a democracy, the U.S. has to be careful when it does approach and designate as a foreign terrorist organization a widespread movement, political movement like the Muslim Brotherhood. I'm in favor of it, but I think we have to be very careful and focus on the elements of what constitutes a foreign terrorist organization. In this case, the key element is violence. Now, certain branches of the Muslim Brotherhood have engaged and continue to engage in violence. So I think, in short, the way to do this is to designate the Egypt branches, the Sudanese branches, and because they have strong track records of using violence to achieve political means, and letting the other branches know that if they wander into the violence means, they too can be designated as foreign terrorists.
Now, tell us first, what is the Muslim Brotherhood? Is there a Muslim Brotherhood, or is it a variety of organizations? We know that it was founded in 1928 in Egypt as a counterweight to the westernization of the country, which was taking place under British rule. What's so terrible about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Right. Again, it's a legitimate political movement in some countries, and a terrorist organization in others. It's very amorphous. It's not like Al-Qaeda, but it shares some of the political aims of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which is to, it was founded not just as a reaction to, as you noted, to the westernization then happening in Egypt, but it was specifically a reaction to the Turkey of Atatürk, Kemal Atatürk, disbanding the caliphate. Remember, the Ottoman Sultan was also a religious leader of Sunni Islam. He was the caliph. And when Atatürk came in, by 1924, he had abolished the caliphate. So the Muslim Brotherhood, the political aim is to achieve political power, to reestablish a universal caliphate. And, you know, it's a supremacist project politically. Now, if they can achieve it through the ballot box, they sometimes do that by getting power, as they did in Egypt again in 2012. They won an election. But in other countries, they also resort to violence to achieve this means. And by the way, in Egypt, when there was a military coup d'etat in 2013 that overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood government, they resorted again to violence, the Muslim Brotherhood, in reaction. So they're tactically very flexible, Jacob. They can be political or they can be a terrorist organization depending on the circumstances. And I think the response needs to be recognizing that the organization is flexible, but when it does resort to violence, then we should be firm and react.
Now, your article's interesting because in it you expand upon your desire to carefully differentiate between the different branches of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you indicate in your article, you say, quote, "The real battle centers on American domestic law, as Secretary of State Rubio recently indicated," unquote. Can you explain to us exactly what that means? What does it mean when you say the battle is about domestic law?
Sure. Because, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood already is banned in quite a few of our Middle Eastern allies, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates have all banned it. But the United States is a democracy. And, you know, actions by our government can and should be, you know, occasionally challenged in courts by those withstanding who are specifically individually affected by such government actions. And so in the U.S., of course, there's a significant American Muslim population, citizens, roughly 1% of the population of the United of the citizenry of the United States, according to the Pew Research surveys, are Muslims. Now, some percentage of that 1% have some ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, which, you know, if you make it into a foreign terrorist organization, they will have standing to challenge that in court. So my point was, if you just blanket designate the Muslim Brotherhood, that won't get you very far because it will be challenged in court by people who have standing to do that inside the U.S. So that is why the Rubio team and the Trump administration in particular have to act very smartly to make sure that this is litigation proof, this designation. And the way to do that is to make a very strong case for those branches that are engaged in violence. And that may require some declassification of intelligence so that it's public. And I would encourage people to do that, because a lot of what our evidence regarding the violence of the Muslim Brotherhood is in intelligence channels.
How significant do you think that the Muslim Brotherhood's support for Hamas has been?
Oh, it's incredibly effective. And, you know, let's keep in mind, Hamas is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is a charter member of the U.S. Foreign Terrorist Organization list from 1998. So it long ago made an irrevocable decision that its way forward was you know, through suicide bombings and massacres of civilians. And it has always been a terrorist organization. But of course, Hamas also stands for elections. Hamas won an election. The last time the Palestinians went to the polls in 2005 for the Palestinian legislature, Hamas won in Gaza. It won a plurality. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is tactically flexible. It can engage in violence when needed. It can stand for elections when feasible, and it can do both and can move back and forth between them. And so we need to react to that. And look, the main support for Hamas financially comes from Qatar, and where a lot of the original Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood people found refuge. You have the famous Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the famous sheikh there, who was an Egyptian, who was sort of the lead theorist, if you would, of the Muslim Brotherhood. He'd passed away recently, but he supported Hamas's suicide bombings as an Islamic thing. And he was based in Qatar, and he was a paid employee supported by the Qatari government. So he was out there inciting violence through support of suicide bombing. But again, he himself did not commit violence. He was speaking on behalf of groups that were doing that. It's different. Hamas is the one conducting the suicide attacks. And I think our designation has to be focused on people committing the violence, promoting the, and then you can go after the people that are materially supporting the violence through fundraising, through recruiting, et cetera.
Now, the aspiration of the Muslim Brotherhood, you point out, is rhetorically to establish a universal caliphate. However, is this a serious goal or is it bluster?
Yes, it's a serious goal. It's nothing rhetorical. I'm reminded of the New Yorker cartoon. I love it, where it's two Aztec priests, you know, carrying or sort of escorting a victim up the steps of the pyramid. And one of the priests turns to tell the victim, look, except for the actual sacrifice, all of this is rhetorical. No, it's nothing rhetorical. Keep in mind, ISIS declared a caliphate, remember? Al-Baghdadi was the caliph. And he, at its height, ISIS controlled a territory that was larger than many countries in the Middle East. It was the eastern part of Syria and the northern part of Iraq, had lots of oil resources as well. So there's been a caliphate declared quite recently, 2014. And that now the Muslim Brotherhood disagrees tactically with ISIS. They would not, as does Al-Qaeda, by the way, all share the same goal. They believe that Islamic law should be the law of everybody. And the way to achieve that is to have a caliphate. Where there is, there's nothing democratic about that. Of course, a caliph is like both a religious and secular ruler, and is supported by the religious clerics. But there's no legislature there. There's no elections there. The person is selected to be the caliph, and becomes the caliph, and then. And by the way, it's always a man. there's no gender equality in any of this equation. The Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that it gets progressives in the United States excited about it, there are no female leadership there. They're always men. And that's just a fact. And women take a back seat, literally, in praying, in Muslim Brotherhood-led mosques and in leadership in the political movement.
Now, Bob, in the what is to be done section of your essay, the concluding part, you call for a state treasury 1-2 punch.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, well, it means that not just to be legally smart about the way you go about this, but to coordinate. The U.S. government has an incredible, powerful ability to turn a foreign terrorist organization designation into a devastating blow to this organization. The way you do that is coordinate. So the State Department has the legal authority under the Immigration and Nationality Act to designate organizations as foreign terrorist organizations. But then you turn it over to Treasury. Treasury, and working with the intelligence community, puts together lists of individuals and companies, front companies, that hold bank accounts that are tied to this organization. And
this is under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, right?
Correct. A different legal authority, but Treasury can designate people as ready for this this bureaucratic term, specially designated terrorist targets, and these people or companies can have all their assets frozen, not just in the U.S., but in countries that the U.S. has strong law enforcement connections with. So, for instance, I participated in this. After 9/11, we went after the financiers for Al-Qaeda. And in Turkey at that time, it was not the Erdogan government. It was a different government under Bülent Ecevit. The Turkish Financial Crimes Authority froze assets of all kinds of Al-Qaeda financiers, many of whom had bank accounts and villas and yachts in Istanbul. Now, when Erdogan came to power, much of that was undone and unfrozen. But for some years, you know, tens of millions of dollars of private Saudi and Yemeni and others who were raising money for Al-Qaeda were frozen in Istanbul because the U.S. asked them to do that. And that can happen again for the Muslim Brotherhood. Many of whom have bank accounts in places like London, Zurich, you name it.
Well, Bob, thank you for that eloquent exposition of your essay, which I really do recommend. There are a number of pieces out there, but this one by Bob Silverman really gives you a detailed understanding of what the U.S. government actually could do. So, Bob, we will have to have you back on the show when you write your next scintillating essay. Many thanks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.